named Kerry Holland saw a black man running away from the area. He appeared to be carrying a stick or something. She wasn't sure. Quincy is black. Seabrook is 80% white, 10% black, 10% Hispanic. Kerry could not identify Quincy, but swore he was of the same height and build as the man she saw. Quincy's court-appointed lawyer succeeded in getting a change of venue, and the trial took place in the county next door. It was 83% white. There was one black person on the jury. The case revolved around the flashlight found in Quincy's trunk. A bloodstain analysis expert from Denver testified that given the location of the body and the probable line of fire from the shotgun and the height of both the deceased and the assailant and the sheer volume of blood found on the walls, floor, bookshelves, and credenza, he was certain that the flashlight was present at the shooting. The mysterious specks on its lens were described as backspatter. They were too small to be tested, so there was no match with Keith's blood. Undaunted by this, the expert told the jury that the specks were definitely blood. Remarkably, the expert admitted that he had never actually seen the flashlight, but had examined it thoroughly by studying a series of color photos taken by the investigators. The flashlight disappeared months before the trial. Diana testified with certainty that her husband knew his ex-client well and was terrified of him. Many times he confided to her that he was afraid of Quincy and even carried a handgun at times. Kerry Holland testified and did everything but point a finger at Quincy. She denied she was being coerced into testifying for the prosecution and denied she had been offered leniency on a pending drug charge. While Quincy was awaiting trial, he was moved to a regional jail in Gainesville. No explanation was given for the transfer. He spent a week there and was returned to Seabrook. However, while away, he was put in a cell with a jailhouse snitch named Zeke Huffy, who testified that Quincy had boasted of the killing and was quite proud of himself. Huffy knew the details of the murder, including the number of shots fired and the gauge of the shotgun. To spice up his testimony, he told the jury that Quincy laughed about driving to the coast the following day and tossing the shotgun into the Gulf. On cross-examination, Huffy denied cutting a deal with the prosecutor for leniency. The investigator from the state police testified that none of Quincy's fingerprints were found at the scene or on the meter box behind the office and was allowed to speculate that the assailant was probably wearing gloves. A pathologist testified and presented large color photographs of the crime scene. The defense lawyer objected strenuously, claiming the photos were highly prejudicial, even inflammatory, but the judge allowed them anyway. Several of the jurors appeared to be shocked by the vivid images of Keith covered in blood with most of his face missing. The cause of death was obvious. Because of his criminal record and other legal problems, Quincy did not take the stand. His lawyer was a rookie named Tyler Townsend, court-appointed and not yet 30 years old. The fact that he had never defended a capital murder client would have normally raised issues on appeal, but not in Quincy's case. His defense was tenacious. Townsend attacked every witness for the state and every piece of evidence. He challenged the experts and their conclusions, pointed out the flaws in their theories, and mocked the sheriff's department for losing the flashlight, the most important piece of evidence. He waved its color photos in front of the jury and questioned whether the specks on the lens were actually blood. He sneered at Kerry Holland and Zeke Huffy and called them liars. He suggested to Diana that she was not the innocent widow and made her cry on cross-examination, which didn't require much effort. He was repeatedly cautioned by the judge but remained unfazed. So zealous was his defense that the jurors often could not mask their contempt for him. The trial became a brawl, as young Tyler rebuked the prosecutors, disrespected the judge, and harangued the state's witnesses. The defense offered an alibi. According to a woman named Valerie Cooper, Quincy was with her at the time of the killing. She was a single mother who lived in Hernando, an hour south of Seabrook. She had met Quincy in a bar, and their romance had been on and off. She claimed to be certain that Quincy had been with her, but on the stand, she was intimidated and not credible. When the prosecutor brought up a drug conviction, she broke down. In his passionate closing argument, Tyler Townsend used two props, a 12-gauge shotgun and a flashlight, and argued that it would have been almost impossible to fire two shots at the target while holding both. The jurors, mostly from rural areas, seemed to understand this, but it made little difference. Tyler was in tears as he begged for a not guilty verdict. He didn't get one. The jury wasted little time convicting Quincy of the murder. His punishment proved more complicated as the jury got hung. Finally, after 2 days of intense and heated debate, the lone black held out for life with no parole. The 11 whites were disappointed that they could not return a death verdict. Quincy's appeals ran their course, and his conviction was unanimously affirmed at every level. For 22 years, he has maintained his innocence, but no one is listening. Young Tyler Townsend was devastated by the loss and never recovered. The town of Seabrook turned against him, and his fledgling law practice dried up. Not long after the appeals were extinguished, he finally gave up and moved to Jacksonville, where he worked as a part-time public defender before pursuing another career. Frankie found him in Fort Lauderdale, where he seems to be living a pleasant life with a family and a good business developing shopping centers with his father-in-law. Approaching him will require care and forethought, something we do well. Diana Russo never returned to Seabrook, and as far as we know, never remarried. But we are not certain. Working with a private security group that we hire occasionally, Vicky found her a year ago living on the island of Martinique. For another chunk of money, our spies can dig deeper and give us more. For the moment, though, we can't justify the money. Trying to have a chat with her would be a waste of time. Exonerating Quincy Miller is our goal. Finding the real killer is not a priority. To succeed at the former, we must unravel the state's case. Solving the crime is someone else's business, and after 22 years, you can bet no one is working on it. This is not a cold case. The state of Florida got a conviction. The truth is irrelevant. Chapter 6. Quincy has spent the last 8 years at a prison called Garvin Correctional Institute near the rural town of Peckham, about an hour north of the sprawl of Orlando. My first visit here was 4 months ago, when I came as a priest doing prison ministry work. I wore my old black shirt and collar then. It's amazing how much more respect I get as a priest than as a lawyer, at least around prisons. I'm wearing the collar again today just to screw with them. Vicky has done the paperwork, and I'm officially on record as Quincy's lawyer. The guard at the front desk studies the paperwork, studies my collar, has questions, but is too confused to ask them. I surrender my cell phone, get cleared through the scanners, and then wait an hour in a dingy holding room where I flip through tabloid magazines and wonder once again what the world is coming to. They finally fetch me, and I follow a guard out to the first building and along a sidewalk lined with fencing and razor wire. I've seen the inside of so many prisons, I'm no longer shocked by their harshness. In so many awful ways, they're all the same. Squat concrete buildings with no windows, wreck yards filled with men in matching uniforms killing time, scowling guards reeking of contempt because I'm a trespasser there to help the lowlifes. We enter another building and walk into a long room with a row of cubicles. The guard opens a door to one and I step inside. Quincy is already there on the other side of a thick plastic window. The door closes and we are alone. To make the visits as difficult as possible, there are no openings in the partition and we are forced to talk with bulky phones that date back at least 3 decades. If I want to pass a document to my client, I have to call a guard who first examines it and then walks it around to the other side. Quincy smiles and taps his fist on the window. I return the salute, and we have officially shaken hands. He's 51 now, and except for the graying hair, he could pass for 40. He lifts weights every day, does karate, tries to avoid the slop they serve him, stays lean, and meditates. He takes his phone and says, "First, Mr. Post, I want to thank you for taking my case." His eyes water immediately, and he's overcome. For at least the last 15 years, Quincy has not had a lawyer or any type of legal representative, not a soul out there in the free world working to prove his innocence. I know from my vast experience that this is a burden that is almost unbearable. A corrupt system locked him away, and there's no one fighting the system. His burdens are heavy enough as an innocent man, but with no voice, he feels truly helpless. I say, "You are indeed welcome. I'm honored to be here. Most of my clients just call me Post, so let's drop the Mr. stuff." Another smile. "Deal. And I'm just Quincy." The paperwork has been filed, so I'm officially on board. Any questions about that? "Yeah. You look more like a preacher or something. Why are you wearing that collar?" "Because I'm an Episcopal priest, and this collar has a way of getting more respect at times. We had a preacher once who wore one of those. Never could understand why." He was raised in the African Methodist Episcopal Church, and their ministers and bishops do indeed wear collars. He dropped out as a teenager. At 18, he married his girlfriend because she was pregnant, and the marriage was never stable. 2 other children followed. I know their names and addresses and places of employment, and I know that they haven't spoken to him since his trial. His ex-wife testified against him. His only brother is Marvis, a saint, who visits him every month and sends him a small check occasionally. Quincy is lucky to be alive. 1 black juror saved his life. Otherwise, he would have gone to death row at a time when Florida was enthusiastically killing folks. As always, Guardian's file on him is thick, and we know as much about him as possible. "So, what do we do now, Post?" he asked with a smile. "Oh, we have a lot of work to do. We start with the scene of the crime and investigate everything."
"That was a long time ago."
"True. But Keith Russo is still dead, and the people who testified against you are still alive. We'll find them, try to gain their trust, and see what they're saying now."
"What about that snitch?"
"Well, surprisingly, the drugs haven't killed him. Huffy's back in prison, this time in Arkansas. He spent 19 of his 40 years behind bars, all due to drugs. I'll go see him."
"You don't expect him to say he lied, do you?"
"Maybe. You never know with snitches. Professional liars have a way of laughing about their lies. Over his miserable career, he snitched in at least 5 other cases, all for sweetheart deals with the cops. He has nothing to gain by sticking to the lies he told your jury."
"I'll never forget when they brought that boy in, all cleaned up with a white shirt and a tie. At first, I didn't recognize him. It had been months since we were in the same cell. And when he started talking about my confession, I wanted to scream at him. It was obvious the cops had fed him details of the crime, cutting off the electricity, using the flashlight, all that stuff. I knew right then that my ass was cooked. I looked at the jurors, and you could tell they were eating it up. All of it. Every last lie he told. And you know what, Post? I sat there listening to Huffy, and I thought to myself, man, that guy swore to tell the truth. And the judge is supposed to make sure all witnesses tell the truth. And the prosecutor, he knows his witnesses lying. He knows the guy cut a deal with the cops to save his ass. Everybody knew. Everybody but those morons on the jury.
I'm ashamed to say it happens all the time, Quincy. Jailhouse snitches testify every day in this country. Other civilized countries prohibit them, but not here. Quincy closes his eyes and shakes his head. He says,
well, when you see that sack of shit, tell him I'm still thinking about him.
Thinking about revenge is not helpful here, Quincy. It's wasted energy.
Maybe so. But I have plenty of time to think about everything. You gonna talk to June?
If she'll talk.
I bet she won't.
His ex-wife remarried 3 years after his trial, then divorced, then remarried again. Frankie found her in Tallahassee living as June Walker. Evidently, she eventually found some stability and is the second wife of Otis Walker, an electrician on the campus at Florida State. They live in a middle-class neighborhood that is predominantly black and have one child together. She has 5 grandchildren from her first marriage, children that Quincy has never seen, even in a photo. Nor has he seen their 3 children since his trial. For him, they exist only as toddlers, frozen in time. Why shouldn't she talk to me? I ask.
Because she lied, too. Come on, Post. They all lied, right? Even the experts.
I'm not sure the experts thought they were lying. They just didn't understand the science, and they gave bad opinions.
Whatever. You figure that out. I know damn well June lied. She lied about the shotgun and the flashlight, and she lied when she told the jury I was somewhere around town the night of the murder.
And why did she lie, Quincy? He shakes his head as if my question is foolish. He puts the phone down, rubs his eyes, and then picks it up again.
We were at war, Post. Should have never got married and damn sure needed a divorce. Russo screwed me big time in the divorce, and suddenly I couldn't pay all that child support and alimony. She was out of work and in a bad way. When I got behind, she sued me again and again. The divorce was bad, but not nearly as bad as what came after. We grew to thoroughly hate each other. When they arrested me for murder, I owed some like $40,000 in payments. Guess I still do. Hell, sue me again.
So it was revenge?
More like hatred. I ain't never owned a shotgun, Post. Check the records.
We have. Nothing.
See?
But records mean little, especially in this state. There are 100 ways to get a gun.
Who you believe, Post? Me or that lying woman?
If I didn't believe you, Quincy, I wouldn't be here.
I know. I can almost understand a shotgun, but why would she lie about that flashlight? I never saw it before. Hell, they couldn't even produce it at trial.
Well, if we are assuming that your arrest, prosecution, and conviction were carefully planned to frame an innocent man, then we must assume the police leaned on June to say the flashlight belonged to you, and hatred was her motive.
But how was I supposed to pay all that money from death row?
Great question, and you're asking me to get inside her mind.
Oh, please don't go there. She's crazy as hell.
We both have a good laugh. He stands and stretches and asks,
how long you staying today, Post?
3 hours.
Hallelujah. You know something, Post? My cell is 6 feet by 10, just about the same size as this little shithole we in now. My cellie is a white boy from downstate. Drugs. Not a bad kid. Not a bad cellie. But can you imagine spending 10 hours a day living with another human in a cage?
No.
Course, we ain't said a word to each other in over a year.
Why not?
Can't stand each other. Nothing against white folks, folks, but there are a lot of differences, you know. I listen to Motown. He likes that country crap. My bunk is neat as a pin. He's a slob. I don't touch drugs. He's stone half the time. Enough of this, Post. Sorry to bring it up. I hate whiners. I'm so glad you're here, Post. You have no idea.
I'm honored to be your lawyer, Quincy.
But why? You don't make much money, do you? I mean, you can't make much representing people like me.
We haven't really discussed fees, have we?
Send me a bill. Then you can sue me.
We laugh and he sits down, the phone cradled in his neck.
Seriously, who pays you?
I work for a nonprofit, and no, I don't make much. But I'm not in it for the money.
God bless you, Post.
Diana Russo testified that on at least two occasions, you went to their office and threatened Keith. True?
No. I was in his office several times during my divorce, but stopped going when the case was over. When he wouldn't talk to me on the phone, I went to the office one time, and hell yes, I was thinking about taking a baseball bat and beating his brains out. But the little receptionist out front said he wasn't in, said he was in court. It was a lie, because his car, a fancy black Jaguar, was parked behind the office. I knew she was lying, and I started to make a scene. But didn't. I bit my tongue and left. Never went back. I swear that's the truth, Post. I swear. Diana lied like everybody else.
She testified that you called their home several times and threatened him.
More lies. Phone calls leave a trail, Post. I ain't that stupid. My lawyer, Tyler Townsend, tried to get the records from the phone company, but Diana blocked him. He tried to get a subpoena, but we ran out of time during the trial. After I was convicted, the judge wouldn't approve a subpoena. We never got those records. By the way, have you talked to Tyler?
No. But he's on the list. We know where he is.
Good dude. Post, a real good dude. That young man believed me and fought like hell, a real bulldog. I know you lawyers get a bad rap, but he was a good one.
Any contact with him?
Not anymore. It's been too long. We wrote letters for years, even after he quit the law. He told me once in a letter that my case broke his spirit. He knew I was innocent, and when he lost my case, he lost faith in the system. Said he couldn't be part of it. He stopped by about 10 years ago, and it was a blessing to see him. But it also brought back bad memories. He actually cried when he saw me, Post.
Did he have a theory about the real killer? He lowers the phone and looks at the ceiling as if the question is too involved. He raises it again and asks,
"You trust these phones, Post?"
It's against the law for the prison to eavesdrop on confidential talks between a lawyer and his client, but it happens. I shake my head, no.
Neither do I,
he says.
But my letters to you are safe, right?
Right. A prison cannot open mail related to legal matters, and it has been my experience that they don't try. It's too easy to notice if mail has been tampered with. Quincy uses sign language to indicate he will put it in writing. I nod. The fact that he has spent 22 years inside a prison where he is presumably safe from the outside and is still worried is revealing. Keith Russo was murdered for a reason. Someone other than Quincy Miller planned the killing, pulled it off with precision, then got away. What followed was a thorough framing that involved several conspirators, smart guys, whoever they were and are. Finding them may be impossible, but if I didn't think we could prove Quincy's innocence, I wouldn't be sitting here. They're still out there, and Quincy is still thinking about them. The 3 hours pass quickly as we cover many topics. Books, he reads 2 or 3 a week. My exonerees, he's fascinated by the ones we've freed. Politics, He stays abreast with newspapers and magazines. Music? He loves the 1960s stuff from Detroit. Corrections. He rails against a system that does so little to rehabilitate. Sports. He has a small color television and lives for the games, even hockey. When the guard taps on my door, I say goodbye and promise to be back. We touch fists at the window, and he thanks me again. Chapter 7. The Chevrolet Impala owned by Otis Walker is parked at an employee's lot behind a physical plant at the edge of campus. Frankie is parked nearby waiting. It's a 2006 model, purchased used by Otis and financed through a credit union. Vicky has the records. His second wife, June, drives a Toyota sedan with no liens. Their 16-year-old son doesn't have his license yet. At 5 minutes after 5 p.m., Otis emerges from the building with two co-workers and heads for the parking lot. Frankie gets out and checks a tire. The co-workers scatter and yell goodbye. As Otis is about to open his driver's door, Frankie materializes from nowhere and says,
"Say, Mr. Walker, you got a second?"
Otis is immediately suspicious, but Frankie is a black guy with a pleasant smile, and Otis is not the first stranger he's approached.
"Maybe,"
he says. Frankie offers his hand and says,
"My name's Frankie Tatum, and I'm an investigator for a lawyer out of Savannah."
Now Otis is even more suspicious. He opens the door, tosses in his lunch pail, closes the door, and says,
"Okay."
Frankie raises both hands in mock surrender and says,
"I come in peace. I'm just looking for information about an old case."
At this point, a white man would have been rebuffed, but Frankie appears harmless.
"I'm listening," Otis says. "I'm sure your wife has talked about her first husband, Quincy Miller."
The name causes a slight sag of the shoulders, but Otis is curious enough to continue for a moment.
"Not much," he says. "A long time ago. Why are you involved with Quincy?" "The lawyer I work for represents him. We're convinced Quincy got framed for that murder, and we're trying to prove it."
"Good luck with that one. Quincy got what he deserved."
"Not really, Mr. Walker. Quincy is an innocent man who served 22 years for somebody else's crime."
"You really believe that?"
"I do. So does the lawyer I worked for."
Otis considers this for a moment. He has no record, has never been to prison, but his cousin is doing hard time for assaulting a police officer. In white America, prisons are good places where bad men pay for their crimes. In black America, they are too often used as warehouses to keep minorities off the streets. Otis asks,
"So who killed that lawyer?"
"We don't know and may never know. But we're just trying to find the truth and get Quincy out."
"I'm not sure I can help you."
"But your wife can. She testified against him. I'm sure she's told you all about it."
Otis shrugs and glances around.
"Maybe, but it was a long time ago. She hasn't mentioned Quincy's name in years."
"Can I talk to her?"
"Talk about what?"
"Her testimony." "She didn't tell the truth, Mr. Walker. She told the jury that Quincy owned a 12-gauge shotgun. That was a murder weapon, and it was owned by somebody else."
"Look, I met June years after the murder. In fact, she had another husband before she met me. I'm number three. You understand? I know she had a rough time when she was younger, but our life is pretty good right now. The last thing she wants is any trouble related to Quincy Miller."
"I'm asking for help, Otis, that's all. We got a brother wasting away in prison not 2 hours from here. The white cops and white prosecutor and white jury said he killed a white lawyer. Didn't happen that way."
Otis spits, leans on his door, and crosses his arms over his chest. Frankie gently presses on.
Look, I served 14 years in Georgia for somebody else's murder. I know what it's like, okay? I got lucky and got out. But I left some innocent guys behind, guys like me and you. There's a lot of us in prison. The system's rigged against us, Otis. We're only trying to help Quincy.
So what's June got to do with this?
Has she ever told you about the flashlight?
Otis thinks for a second and shakes his head. Frankie doesn't want a gap in the conversation.
There was a flashlight with some blood on it. Cops said it came from the crime scene. Quincy never saw it, never touched it. June told the jury he had one very similar to it.
Not true, Otis. Not true.
She also told the jury that Quincy was somewhere around Seabrook the night of the killing. Not true. He was with a girlfriend an hour away.
Otis has been married to June for 17 years. Frankie is assuming he is quite aware of her struggles with the truth, so why beat around the bush?
You're calling her a liar? Otis said.
No, not now. But you said yourself she was a different woman back then. She and Quincy were at war. He owed her a bunch of money that he couldn't pay. The cops leaned on her to take the stand and point the finger.
A long time ago, man.
Damn right. Ask Quincy about it. He spent 22 years in prison.
Well, let's say she didn't tell the truth back then. You expect her to admit it now? Come on.
I just want to talk to her. I know where she works. I could have gone there, but we don't operate that way. This is not an ambush, Otis. I respect your privacy, and I'm asking you to run it by June. That's all.
Feels like an ambush.
What else could I do? Send an email? Look, I'm leaving town. You talk to her and see what she says.
I know what she'll say. She ain't got nothing to do with Quincy Miller.
I'm afraid she does.
Frankie hands him a Guardian Ministries business card.
Here's my phone number. I'm just asking for a favor, Otis.
Otis takes it and reads the front and back.
You with some kind of church?
No. The guy who runs it is the lawyer who got me out of prison. He's a preacher, too. Good guy. This is all he does. Gets innocent folk out.
White guy?
Yep.
Must be a bad dude.
You'd like him. So would June. Give us a chance, Otis.
Don't bet on it.
Thanks for your time.
Don't mention it.
Chapter 8. At Guardian, we have a collection of brochures we use for a variety of purposes. If our target is a white guy, I use the one with my smiling face front and center, with the collar. If we need to approach a white woman, we'll use Vicky's. Blacks get the one with Maisie arm in arm with a black exoneree. We like to say that skin color doesn't matter, but that's not always true. We often use it to open doors. Since Z. Cuffey is white, I sent him my brochure with a chatty letter informing him that his plight has come to the attention of our little foundation and we're reaching out. 2 weeks later, I received a handwritten letter on ruled notebook paper thanking me for my interest. I responded with my usual follow-up and asked if he needed anything. Not surprisingly, his next letter asked for money. I sent him a $200 moneygram with another letter asking if it's okay to visit him. Of course it's okay. Zeke is a career criminal who has done time in 3 states. He is originally from the Tampa area, but we have found no trace of his family. When he was 25, he married a woman who quickly divorced him when he was convicted of drug trafficking. As far as we know, he has no children, and we're assuming his visitors are scarce. 3 years ago, he got busted in Little Rock, Arkansas, and is currently doing 5 years in the land of opportunity. His career as a snitch began with the trial of Quincy Miller. He was 18 when he testified, and a month after the trial, his drug charges were reduced and he walked. That deal worked so beautifully that he did it again and again. Every jail has a druggie facing more time and eager to avoid it. With the proper coaching from cops and prosecutors, a snitch can be quite effective with his perjury. Jurors simply cannot believe that a witness, any witness, will take the oath, swear to tell the truth, then tell them an outlandish story of pure fiction. These days, Zeke is doing time at a satellite prison in the middle of the cotton fields of northeastern Arkansas. I'm not sure why it is referred to as a satellite. It's a prison with all the usual dreary architecture and fencing. Unfortunately, the facility is operated for profit by an out-of-state corporation, which means the guards earn even less and there are fewer of them. The terrible food is even worse. The commissary gouges the men on everything from peanut butter to toilet paper, and the medical care is almost non-existent. I suppose that in America, everything, including education and corrections, is fair game for profiteers. I am led to a room with a row of enclosed booths for attorney visits. A guard locks me inside. I take a seat and stare at a thick plastic divider. Minutes pass, then half an hour, but I'm in no hurry. The door on the other side opens, and Zeke Huffy steps in. He offers me a smile as the guard removes the handcuffs. When we're alone, he says, "Why are we in a lawyer's room?" He's looking at my collar. "Nice to meet you, Zeke. Thanks for taking the time."
"Oh, I got plenty of time. Didn't know you were a lawyer."
"I'm a lawyer and a priest." "How are they treating you here?" He laughs and lights a cigarette. Of course, the room has no ventilation.
"I've seen my share of prisons, and this has to be the worst," he says. "Owned by the state, but leased to an outfit called Atlantic Corrections Corporation. Ever heard of them?"
"Yes, I've been a guest in several of their units. Seriously bad stuff, right?"
$4 for a roll of toilet paper. Should be $1. They give us one roll per week, sandpaper, and it makes you limp when you walk. I guess I'm lucky you sent me that money. Thank you, Mr. Post. Some of my buddies never see a dime from the outside."
Hideous prison tattoos are crawling up his neck. His eyes and cheeks are sunken, the look of a street addict who's been stoned on cheap drugs for most of his life. I say, "I'll send some more money when I can, but we operate on a pretty lean budget."
"Who is we? And why are you really here? A lawyer ain't going to help me."
"I work for a nonprofit foundation dedicated to saving innocent men. One of our clients is Quincy Miller. Remember him?" He chuckles and releases a cloud of smoke.
"So you're here under false pretenses, huh?"
"You want me to leave?"
"Depends on what you want."
As a career criminal, Zeke knows that the game has suddenly changed. I want something that only he possesses, and he's already thinking about how to capitalize. He has played this game before. I say, "Let's start with the truth." He laughs and says,
"Truth, justice, and the American way. You must be a fool, Mr. Post, searching for the truth in a place like this."
"It's my job, Zeke. It's the only way I can get Quincy out of prison. You and I both know that you're an experienced snitch who lied to the jury at Quincy's trial. He never confessed to you. The details of the crime were fed to you by the cops and prosecutor who rehearsed your story with you. The jury bought it, and Quincy has been locked up for 22 years. It's time to get him out." He smiles as if he's only humoring me.
"I'm hungry. Can you fetch me a Coke and some peanuts?"
"Sure." It's not unusual, even in a place like this, for visitors to buy snacks. I tap on my door and a guard eventually opens it. He and I walk to a wall of vending machines where I start shoving in quarters. $2 for a 12-ounce soda, $1 each for 2 small packs of peanuts. The guard takes me back to our room and a few minutes later appears on Zeke's side and hands him the goodies. "Thanks," he says, and takes a drink. It's important to keep the conversation flowing, so I ask, "How did the cops convince you to testify against Quincy?"
"You know how they operate, Mr. Post. They're always looking for witnesses, especially when they got no proof. I don't remember all the details. It was a long time ago."
"Yes, it's certainly been a long time for Quincy. Do you ever think about him, Zeke? You know how bad prison is. You ever stop and think that you helped put an innocent man behind bars for the rest of his life?"
"Not really. Been too busy doing other things, you know."
"Don't know. Quincy has a chance of getting out. It's a long shot, but then all of them are. This is my work, Zeke, and I know what I'm doing. We need your help."
"Help? What am I supposed to do?"
"Tell the truth. Sign an affidavit saying that you lied at trial and you did so because the cops and prosecutors offered you a sweet deal." He crunches on a mouthful of peanuts and studies the floor. I press on. "I know what you're thinking, Zeke. You're thinking that Florida is far away and you have no desire to get involved in a case this old. You're thinking that if you come clean now with the truth, then the cops and prosecutor will charge you with perjury and lock you up again. But that's not going to happen. The statute of limitations on perjury ran out a long time ago. Plus, they're all gone. The sheriff retired. The prosecutor did too. The judge is dead. The system back there has no interest in you whatsoever. You have nothing to gain and nothing to lose by helping Quincy get out. It's really a no-brainer, Zeke. Do the right thing. Tell the truth, and your life goes on."
"Look, Mr. Post, I get out in 17 months, and I'm not doing anything to screw that up. Arkansas doesn't care what you did in a Florida courtroom 22 years ago. You didn't perjure yourself here. These guys couldn't care less. Once you're paroled, their only concern is filling your cell with the next man. You know how it all works, Zeke. You're a pro at this game." He's stupid enough to smile at this compliment. He likes the idea of being in control. He sips his Coke, lights another cigarette, finally says,
"I don't know, Mr. Post. It sounds awfully risky to me. Why should I get involved?"
"Why not? You have no loyalty to the cops and prosecutors. They don't care what happens to you, Zeke. You're on the other side of the street. Do something good for one of your own." There is a long gap in the conversation. Time means nothing. He finishes one pack of peanuts and opens the second. He says,
"Never knew of lawyers who do what you do. How many innocent people have you sprung?"
8 in the past 10 years, all innocent. We have 6 clients now, including Quincy.
"Can you get me out?"
he says, and it strikes both of us as funny.
"Well, Zeke, if I thought you were innocent, I might give it a shot. Probably a waste of your time."
"Probably so. Can you help us, Zeke?"
"When's all this going down?"
"Well, we're hard at work now. We investigate everything and build a case for innocence, but it's slow work, as you might guess. There's no real rush on your part, but I would like to keep in touch."
"You do that, Mr. Post. And if you find a few extra bucks, pass them along. Peanuts and a Coke mean fine dining in this dump."
"I'll send some money, Zeke. And if you find a few extra minutes of time, think about Quincy. You owe him one."
"That I do."
Chapter 9. Carrie Holland was 19 years old when she told Quincy's jury that she saw a black man running down a dark street at the time of the murder. He was of the same height and build as Quincy and was carrying what appeared to be a stick or something. She said she had just parked her car in front of an apartment building, heard two loud noises coming from the direction of the Russo's law office 3 blocks away, and saw a man running. On cross-examination, Tyler Townsend attacked. She didn't live in the apartment building, but said she was there to visit a friend. The friend's name? When she hesitated, Tyler reacted with disbelief and mocked her. When he said, "Give me the friend's name and I'll call her as a witness," the prosecution objected and the judge sustained. From the transcript, it appeared as though she couldn't remember a name. Tyler zeroed in on the dark street, one without lighting. Using a map, he pinpointed the buildings and the distance from her car to the Russo's office and raised questions about her ability to see what she claimed she saw. He argued with her until the judge intervened and made him stop. She had a drug charge from the year before, and Tyler assaulted her with it. He asked her if she was under the influence on the witness stand and suggested that she was still struggling with addiction. He demanded to know if it was true that she had been dating a deputy on the Ruiz County Police Force. She denied this. When his cross-examination dragged on, the judge asked him to speed things along. When he protested that the prosecutor seemed to be taking his time, the judge threatened him with contempt, and not for the first time. When Tyler was finished with Carrie Holland, he had raised doubts about her credibility, but he had also verbally abused her to the point of making her sympathetic to the jury. Not long after the trial, Carrie left the area. She lived for a while near Columbus, Georgia, married a man there, had 2 kids, got a divorce, and dropped out of sight. It took Vicky a year and one of her many desktop investigations to find the witness living as Carrie Pruitt in a remote part of eastern Tennessee. She works in a furniture factory near Kingsport and lives off a county road in a mobile home she shares with a man called Buck. To her credit, she has managed to stay out of trouble. Her rap sheet has only the drug conviction from Seabrook, one that was never expunged. We're assuming that Carrie is clean and sober, and in our business, that's always a plus. A month ago, Frankie eased into the area and did his usual reconnaissance. He has photos of her mobile home and the acreage around it and of the factory where she is employed. Working with an investigator from Kingsport, he has learned that she has 1 son in the Army and another living in Knoxville. Buck drives a truck and has no criminal record. Oddly enough, his father once pastored a small rural church 20 miles from where they live. There could be an element of stability in the family. There is also an excellent chance that neither Buck nor anyone else within 500 miles knows much about her past. This complicates matters. Why should she revisit her brief encounter with Quincy Miller 2 decades earlier and upset her life now? I meet Frankie at a pancake house in Kingsport, and over waffles, we discuss the photos. The mobile home is remote with a fenced dog run out back, where Buck keeps some hounds. He drives the obligatory pickup. She has a Honda. Vicky has run the tag numbers and verified ownership. Neither is registered to vote. A nice bass boat sits under a shelter beside the trailer. Buck is obviously serious about his hunting and fishing.
"I don't like the looks of this place," Frankie says, shuffling the photos.
"I've seen worse," I say, and I certainly have. I've knocked on a lot of doors where I expected to be met by either a Doberman or a rifle. But let's assume Buck doesn't know about her past, never heard about Quincy. If we assume that, then we can also assume she really would like to keep it quiet.
"Agreed. So stay away from the house."
"What time does she leave for work?"
I don't know, but she punches in at 8, out at 5, doesn't leave for lunch. Makes about $9 an hour. She's on an assembly line, not in an office, so you can't call her at work. And she won't talk around her co-workers. What's the weather forecast for Saturday?
Clear and sunny. Perfect day for fishing.
Let's hope so. At daybreak Saturday, Frankie is pumping gas at a convenience store a mile from the trailer. It's our lucky day, or so we think for a moment. Buck and a friend roll past towing the bass rig, headed for a lake or a river. Frankie calls me, and I immediately call the listed number of their landline. A sleepy woman answers the phone. In a friendly voice, I say, "Ms. Pruitt, my name is Cullen Post, and I'm a lawyer from Savannah, Georgia. Got a minute?"
"Who? What do you want?"
The sleepiness vanishes. "Cullen Post is my name. I'd like to talk to you about a trial you were involved in a long time ago."
"You got the wrong number."
"You were Carrie Holland back then, and you lived in Seabrook, Florida. I have all the records, Carrie, and I'm not here to cause you any trouble."
"Wrong number, mister."
"I represent Quincy Miller. He's been in prison for 22 years because of you, Carrie. The least you can do is give me 30 minutes. The line goes dead. 10 minutes later, I park in front of the trailer. Frankie is not far away, just in case I get shot. Carrie finally comes to the door, opens it slowly, and steps onto the narrow wooden porch. She is slim and wearing tight jeans. Her blonde hair is pulled back. Even with no makeup, she is not a bad-looking woman. But the years of nicotine have bunched lines of wrinkles around her eyes and mouth. She holds a cigarette and glares at me. I'm wearing my collar, but she is not impressed by it. I smile and say, "Sorry to barge in like this, but I just happened to be in the area."
"What do you want?"
she asks and takes a puff. "I want my client out of prison, Carrie, and that's where you come in. Look, I'm not here to embarrass or harass you. I'll bet Buck has never heard of Quincy Miller, right? Can't blame you for that. I wouldn't talk about it either, but Quincy is still serving hard time for a murder committed by someone else. He didn't kill anyone. You didn't see a black man running from the scene. You testified because the cops leaned on you, right? You had been dating one of them, and so they knew you. They needed a witness, and you had that little drug problem. Right, Carrie?"
"How'd you find me?"
"You're not exactly hiding."
"Get out of here before I call the law."
I raise my hands in mock surrender. "No problem. It's your property. I'm leaving." I toss a business card on the grass and say, "Here's my number. My job will not allow me to forget about you, so I'll be back. And I promise I will not blow your cover. I just want to talk, that's all, Carrie. You did a terrible thing 22 years ago, and it's time to make it right." She doesn't move and watches me drive away. The letter from Quincy is handwritten in neat block letters. It must have taken him hours. It reads,
"Dear Post, thank you, sir, once again for taking my case. You cannot know what it means to be locked up like this with no one out there believing in you. I'm a different person these days, Post, and it's all because of you. Now get to work and get me out of here. You asked me if my wonderful young lawyer, Tyler Townsend, had a theory about the real murderer. He did. He told me many times that it was well known around that part of Florida that Keith Russo and his wife were involved with the wrong people. They were lawyers for some drug dealers. They started making a lot of money, and this got noticed. There ain't much money in Seabrook, not even for lawyers, and folks became suspicious. The High Sheriff Fitzner was a crook himself, and Tyler said he was in on the drugs, probably in on the killing, too. I know this for a fact, Post. Somebody put that damn flashlight in the trunk of my car, and I just know it was Fitzner. The whole deal was one big frame job. They knew it would be easier to convict a black guy in Seabrook than a white one, and man, they got that right. A friend said I should hire Russo for my divorce. Bad, bad advice. He charged me too much money and did a terrible job. About halfway through, I could tell he didn't want to be no divorce lawyer. When the judge hit me with all that alimony and child support, I said to Russo, "Man, you got to be kidding me. No way I can pay all that." You know what he said? Said, "You lucky it wasn't more." The judge was a big church man and really disliked men who chased skirts. My ex said I was screwing around. Russo acted like I got what I deserved. Russo himself was a ladies' man. Anyway, enough of that. He's dead. Tyler didn't know why they killed Russo. But when you're dealing with a drug gang, you have to figure he double-crossed them in some way. Maybe he kept too much of the money. Maybe he was snitching. Maybe his wife didn't want to lose everything they had. I met her a few times when I was in the office and didn't like her. One tough gal. After my trial, Tyler got threats and he was really scared. They finally ran him out of town. He said there were some bad people back there and he was moving on. Years later, after my appeals were over and he wasn't my lawyer anymore, he told me that a deputy sheriff got killed in Seabrook, said he thought it was related to the Russo murder and the drug gangs. But he was only speculating by then. So there it is, Post. Tyler's theory of who really killed Russo. And he also thought that Russo's wife was probably involved, too. But it's too late to prove any of that. Thanks again, Post. Hope this is helpful. And I hope to see you soon. Get busy. Your client and friend, Quincy Miller.
Chapter 10. The bloodstain expert who testified against Quincy was a former Denver homicide detective named Paul Norwood. After working crime scenes for a few years, he had decided to hand in his badge, buy a couple of nice suits, and become an expert witness. He had dropped out of college and did not have the time to pursue a degree in criminology or anything related to actual science. So he attended seminars and workshops on forensics, and he read books and magazine articles written by other experts. He was a smooth talker with a good vocabulary, and he found it easy to convince judges that he knew his stuff. Once qualified as a forensics expert, he found it even easier to convince unsophisticated jurors that his opinions were based on solid science. Norwood was far from alone. In the 1980s and 1990s, expert testimony proliferated in the criminal courts as all manner of self-anointed authorities roamed the country impressing juries with their freewheeling opinions. To make matters worse, popular television crime shows portrayed forensic investigators as brilliant sleuths able to solve complex crimes with infallible science. The famous ones could practically look at a bloodied corpse and within an hour or two name the killer. In real life, thousands of criminal defendants were convicted and put away by shaky theories about bloodstains, blood spatter, arson, bite marks, fabrics, glass breakage, scalp and pubic hair, boot prints, ballistics, and even fingerprints. Good defense lawyers challenged the credibility of these experts, but were rarely successful. Judges were often overwhelmed by the science and had little or no time to educate themselves. If a proffered witness had some training and seemed to know what he was talking about, he was allowed to testify. Over time, judges adopted the rationale that since a witness had been qualified as an expert in other trials in other states, then certainly he must be a genuine authority. Appellate courts got into the act by affirming convictions without seriously questioning the science behind the forensics and thus bolstering the reputations of the experts. As resumes grew thicker, the opinions grew to encompass even more theories of guilt. The more Paul Norwood testified, the smarter he became. 1 year before Quincy's trial in 1988, Norwood spent 24 hours in a bloodstain analysis seminar put on by a private company in Kentucky. He passed the course, was given a certificate to prove his knowledge, and added another field of expertise to his growing repertoire. He was soon impressing juries with his scientific knowledge of the many intricate ways blood is dispersed in a grisly crime. He specialized in blood, crime scene reconstruction, ballistics, and hair analysis. He advertised his services, networked with law enforcement and prosecutors, and even wrote a book on forensics. His reputation grew, and he was in demand. Over a 25-year career, Norwood testified in hundreds of criminal trials, always for the prosecution and always implicating the defendant, and always for a nice fee. Then DNA testing arrived and put a serious dent in his business. DNA testing not only changed the future of criminal investigations, it brought a fresh and devastating scrutiny to the junk science Norwood and his ilk had been peddling. In at least half of the DNA exonerations of innocent men and women, bad forensics have been the cornerstone of the prosecution's evidence. In 1 year, 2005, three of Norwood's convictions were invalidated when DNA testing exposed his faulty methods and testimony. His three victims had spent a combined 59 years in prison, one on death row. He retired under pressure after a single trial in 2006. On cross-examination, after giving his standard bloodstain analysis, he was discredited like never before. The defense lawyer painfully walked him through each of the prior year's three exonerations. The questioning was brilliant, brutal, and revealing. The defendant was found not guilty. The real killer was later identified, and Norwood called it quits. However, the damage was done. Quincy Miller had long since been convicted because of Norwood's analysis of the bloody flashlight, which, of course, he had never seen. His razor-sharp analysis of the case consisted of reviewing large color photos of the crime scene and the flashlight. He never touched the most crucial piece of evidence, but rather relied on photos of it. Undaunted by this, he testified with certainty that the specks of blood on the lens were backspatter from the shotgun blast that killed Keith Russo. The flashlight disappeared before the trial. Norwood refuses to discuss the case with me. I've written him twice. He responded once and said he would not talk about it, not even on the phone. He claims he's in bad health. The case was a long time ago, his memory is failing, and so on. Not that a conversation would be that productive. As of now, at least seven of his convictions have been exposed as frauds, and he is regularly used as the poster boy for junk science gone awry. Death penalty lawyers attack regularly. He's even been sued. Bloggers excoriate him for the misery he created. Appellate judges detail his wretched career. An innocence group is trying to raise a fortune in funds to review all of his cases. But that kind of money is hard to find. If given an audience, I would ask him to repudiate his work and try to help Quincy, but so far, he has shown no sign of remorse. With or without Norwood, we have no choice but to hire our own forensic scientists, and the best ones are expensive. I'm in Savannah for a couple of days putting out fires. Vicky, Maisie, and I are in the conference room discussing forensics. On the table in front of us are four resumes, our final four. All are top criminologists with impeccable credentials. We'll start with two and send them the case. The cheapest wants $15,000 for a review and consultation. The most expensive gets $30,000, and there's no negotiating. As innocence work has intensified over the past decade, these guys have become highly sought after by groups advocating for the wrongfully convicted. Our top man is Dr. Kyle Benderschmidt at Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond. He has taught for decades and has built one of the leading forensic science departments in the country. I've talked to other lawyers, and they rave about him. We try to keep $75,000 in a war chest to pay experts, private investigators, and lawyers when necessary. We don't like to pay lawyers, and over the years we have become quite convincing at begging sympathetic litigators to go pro bono. We have a loose network of them around the country, and some scientists will reduce their fees to help an innocent person, but that's rare. Benderschmidt's standard rate is $30,000. "Do we have it?" I ask Vicky. "Of course," she says with a smile, always the optimist. If we don't have it, she'll get on the phone and fire up some donors. "Then let's hire him," I say. Maisie agrees. We move on to the second expert. Maisie says, "Looks like you're off to another slow start on this one, Post. I mean, you've struck out with June Walker, Zeke Huffey, and Carrie Holland. So far, nobody wants to talk to you." As with any office, there is a fair amount of good-natured ribbing within Guardian. Vicky and Maisie get along well enough, though each gives the other a wide berth. When I'm in town, I become an easy target. If we didn't love each other, we would be throwing rocks. I laugh and say, "No kidding. And please remind me of the last case where we got off to a fast start." "We're a tortoise, not a rabbit," Vicky says, offering one of her favorites. I say, "Yep, it took us 3 years before we signed on. You want an exoneration in a month?" "Just show us some progress," Maisie says. "I haven't hit the charm button yet," I say. Maisie smiles along. "When are you going to Seabrook?" "Don't know. I'm putting it off as long as I can. No one there knows we're involved, and I'd like to stay in the shadows." "What's the level of fear?" Vicky asks. "Hard to say, but it's definitely a factor. If Russo got himself rubbed out by a drug gang, then those guys are still around. The killer is among them. When I show up, they'll probably know it."
"It sounds awfully risky, Post," Maisie says.
"It is, but there's risk in most of our cases, right? Our clients are in prison because someone else pulled the trigger. They're still out there, laughing because the cops nailed the wrong guy. The last thing they want is an innocence lawyer digging through the old case."
"Just be careful," Vicky says.
It's obvious these two have worried at length behind my back. I'm always careful. "Are you cooking tonight?"
"Sorry, bridge."
"We're having frozen pizza,"
Maisie says. She dislikes cooking, and with four kids at home, she relies heavily on the frozen food section.
"Is James around?"
I ask. Maisie and her husband separated a few years back and attempted a divorce. It didn't work, but living together is not working either. She knows I truly care, and I'm not being nosy.
"He comes and goes. Spend some time with the kids."
"I pray for you guys.
I know you do, Post. And we pray for you."
I don't keep food in my penthouse because it tends to rot from neglect. Since I can't squeeze a meal out of either of my colleagues, I work until after dark, then go for a long walk through the old section of town. Christmas is 2 weeks away, and the air is cool. I've been in Savannah for a dozen years, but don't really know the city. I'm away too much to enjoy its charm and history, and it's difficult to foster friendships with a nomadic lifestyle. But my first friend is at home and looking for company. Luther Hodges hired me out of seminary and enticed me to Savannah. He's retired now, and his wife died a few years ago. He lives in a small cottage owned by the diocese, 2 blocks from Chippewa Square. He's waiting on the porch, eager to get out of the house. "Hello, Padre," I say as we embrace.
"Hello, my son,"
he says piously, our standard greetings.
"You look thin,"
he says. He worries about my lifestyle, bad diet, little sleep, stress. "Well, you certainly don't," I reply. He pats his stomach and says,
"I can't stay away from the ice cream."
"I'm starving. Let's go." We're on the sidewalk, arm in arm, strolling, Whitaker Street. Luther is almost 80 now, and with each visit I notice he's moving a bit slower. He has a slight limp and needs a new knee, but says replacement parts are for geezers.
"You just can't let the old man in,"
is one of his favorite lines.
"Where have you been?"
he asks. "The usual, here and there."
"Tell me about the case,"
he says. He is fascinated by my work and wants updates. He knows the names of Guardian's clients and follows any developments online. I talk about Quincy Miller and our typical slow start,